Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We've got a full show for you this morning, and by the end of it, you're going to be armed with plenty of great info that you'll be dropping into conversations as you reemerge back into society. You'll be able to wow people with your knowledge of mosquitoes and the legislature's veto override session. You'll talk about Shrubley and a berry called Aronia and stun people when you tell them about Vermont High School Rodeo. Who knew, right? Let's get the party train of pure knowledge rolling with mosquito talk. I know of all the creatures on this planet, you've always thought of these as probably the most useless. Well, they do have a purpose, and you'll get to hear about that. But we're also going to learn about how to keep their numbers to a minimum. Here to fight both sides of the mosquito divide is Craig Zondag. He's a field coordinator, biologist at Lemon Fair Insect Control District, and he joins us now. Craig, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Good morning. Listeners, if you've got questions about mosquitoes or how to keep them away from your property, Craig can answer them at 244-1777. 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Craig, how many different types of mosquitoes do we have here in Vermont?
In Vermont, we have about 48 to 49 species.
Are you serious? Are they all basically the same, or do they bite more or carry things like West Nile virus or Eastern equine encephalitis?
Yes, there's actually quite a number of them that are really benign in the environment and don't bother humans at all. Of the 48 to 49 species, there's 9 genera or family groups in the state. But in the bigger picture, we're talking, you know, globally, there's 3,500 species of mosquitoes worldwide, less Antarctica, Iceland, and a few of the Polynesian micro-islands. And of that 3,500, only 100 species are attracted to humans. So what about the other 3,400 species?
Yeah, let's get more of those around here.
Yeah, those are a significant source of food in the food chain. Locally, you know, for dragonflies, fish, frogs, birds, a lot of things. The biomass that mosquitoes provide are really essential to the quality and the health of this planet. And if we were to remove all the mosquitoes from the planet, instantly we would lose 50% of all of our bird species. And it would have just ripple effects across the landscape on plants as well.
So have you been hired, Craig, by the pro-mosquito lobby to, you know, kind of fight their side of things and say, you know, mosquitoes aren't all bad?
I wish I was. Yeah, I think, you know, we had this conversation yesterday briefly. You know, it's like it would be hard to be a defense lawyer for mosquitoes because they are the deadliest predator on the planet. They are responsible for more human deaths than any given war and all combined wars between humans on this planet, and they definitely warrant our attention. You know, we're all hardwired to the frequency of the wings of a mosquito flying around our heads. I know, myself included, you know, I'll sleep through my alarm, but if I have a mosquito buzzing around my ear at 2 o'clock in the morning, I bolt up like the house is on fire.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people do that. It's just in our hard wiring ever since, you know, for the last 200,000 years of human existence.
You do see the business opportunity here, Craig. It would be to create an alarm clock that has that mosquito buzzing as the alarm, right?
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, someone will grab that and get rich.
No one wants to reset that. All right, so there is good stuff about mosquitoes, but why do, especially the 100 species that bite humans, why do mosquitoes bite?
Yeah, Yeah, that's a really good question. So, first of all, let's just clarify. It's only the female mosquito that requires a blood meal. The males are really getting their food from the nectar of flowers. They actually cross-pollinate a lot of plants in the world. And when females can't get a blood meal, they will also get food from nectar and plants. But the female mosquito requires that blood meal for the maturation and development of her eggs. She needs that blood protein for egg development, and so that's why only the female mosquitoes are the ones that will suck blood from a mammal or bird or anything like that.
Wow! So mosquitoes provide food for birds, and they help pollinate. So two really important roles for the mosquito that we should keep in mind. Can you just take us kind of briefly through the life cycle of a mosquito, right up into the point where I squish him as he's or she is taking a pint of my blood?
Right. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
Mosquito science and the natural history of mosquitoes is really varied. We in the Lemaitre Insect Control District, we try to manage the floodplain mosquitoes in the Lemaitre River. And so that's primarily a species called Aedes vexans, and it's a nuisance mosquito. And from the time that a female will lay her eggs on the water or in the damp soil next to the high water line, there is a desiccation period, dry down. But the next time that egg gets wet, it might be the opportunity for the mosquito egg to hatch. So from hatching, the mosquito egg hatches and becomes a larva, and it goes through four instar stages of development. So meaning it as it grows, it sheds its skin, it gets a little bit larger each time. And then after that fourth instar, it goes into what's called a pupation or pupate stage. And that's kind of like the chrysalis, where it's no longer feeding and it's transitioning to become an adult mosquito. And then from there, from the pupate, it becomes an adult and then starts doing business as usual. This can take place over a period of a week to 7 days, sometimes 14 days, depending on water temperature and other climatic conditions. But some mosquito larvae will actually winter over and underneath the ice. And so they kind of remain dormant. You know, they go into kind of a hibernation of sorts until spring, and then they get active and start feeding again. The other catch-22 of mosquitoes is that there are certain species of mosquitoes that actually lay their eggs in the environment, and they can lay dormant and viable for up to 3 or 7 years before they actually hatch. So there's this poison parsnip seed bank of mosquito eggs just waiting for the perfect storm to happen. So, you know, people always ask me, what kind of a mosquito year are we going to have? You know, that's not a question you answer in this field. All bets are off because you just never know when all those viable eggs out there could all take off at the same time.
Once they hatch, how long will a mosquito stay alive?
Good question, yeah. A lot of our local mosquitoes actually are fairly long-lived. They up to 3 months, 3.5, 4 months. There's one mosquito that we see in our homes in the wintertime. It's the northern house mosquito. Belongs to the family Culex. And I hope to talk about that a little bit more here. Because that's one that we can take quite a role in preventing their presence around our properties. And it's about 3 to 4 months. Some mosquitoes are, you know, maybe only a few weeks or a couple weeks, depending on the species. So,
Craig, I know a lot of our listeners want to know, why do we have so many mosquitoes here?
Yeah, so again, that's weather dependent. And, so for instance, 2 years ago, we had 7 or 8 weeks straight where we had these 1-inch rain events. And 1-inch rain events aren't enough to put the Lemaitre River at flood. So a lot of people were complaining about mosquitoes, and I would set up light traps on their properties and discover that the mosquitoes I was trapping were not coming from the floodplain, but coming from the wooded environs around their homes. And so what was happening is that those puddles in the forest created from trees that toppled over with their roots pulled up, and they left these, you know, these depressions in the ground that would puddle. They would puddle long enough for mosquito eggs to be laid and hatch and emerge. And then by the end of the week where the puddle had dried down to the point, it would refill again with another one-inch rain. And so it was just kind of pumping that cycle, that woodland and upland cycle of mosquitoes. And so that's one of the variants that can promulgate a hatch. Now, last year, you know, we had an extremely dry season in Vermont. And so our light traps only yielded about 6,700 mosquitoes for the whole season, whereby 3 years ago we trapped over 48,000 mosquitoes.
Oh.
and that was because of the those 1-inch rain events, and they were, you know, all upland mosquitoes.
Craig, what can we do to protect ourselves from mosquitoes?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that a lot of people, what I've experienced in responding to like complaint calls and getting to properties, is doing surveillance on properties and seeing where mosquitoes might actually be coming from other properties. But one thing that's really important is to remove habitat. And habitat is simply puddled water, which attracts that Culex mosquito, Culex pipiens, which is a potential vector for West Nile virus. And that's one mosquito that you just don't want on your property or in your house. So, you know, drain that clogged gutter, you know, clear the gutters, the corrugated drain tubing that goes under the lawn and empties onto the periphery of the property is good resting habitat for blood-fed females, and she'll lay her eggs in those tubes as well. Kiddie pools that are left unattended will breed mosquitoes, window wells that puddle water, tarps that puddle water covering patio furniture, boats, firewood. Boats, kayaks, and canoes and yards, puddling water, wheelbarrows, 5-gallon buckets, dog dishes, bird baths. Just walk your property and see where water is puddled. Even those little basins underneath flower pots that collect water will breed mosquitoes. And so, you know, tip and drain, you know, all that stuff. Keeping your environment dry around the house is a really good start. That way you're not even inviting the presence of mosquitoes to be on the property.
Craig, when you go over to a friend's house, do you walk around their property and tip and drain a lot?
I will bring that to their attention.
But it's a good thing. It's for their protection. It's a good thing.
Yeah, no, I can't help but do it.
Yeah.
And people often will, you know, come back to me or, you know, say, yeah, I've been tipping my bird bath, you know, and cleaning it twice a week, which is perfect. You know, those should be cleaned twice a week anyway. So the other thing is, you know, resting habitat. People don't realize that mosquitoes need resting habitat. So brush piles, tall grasses, dense shrubs, and other dense vegetation. Keeping airflow between the house and your landscape plants is really important. And allowing airflow to move around your house. And your house is already a buffer from wind for mosquitoes. So sometimes when you're walking around the house and you're on the lee side of a house, you'll notice that almost there's mosquitoes over here, but they weren't on the other side of the house. Avoiding being out during those really optimum times when mosquitoes are present, you know, dusk and dawn, you know, protect yourself with long sleeves, long pants, mosquito net headwear if you need to. And if you're inclined, you know, use repellents, but use them safely. Read the label. I can't stress that enough. Oftentimes when I'll use repellents, instead of spraying it loosely onto my body, I might spray the bottom of my pants and my arms of my shirts. But if I'm applying it to my skin, I'll spray it into a tissue and dab it around my neck, you know, sweep it over the top of my head, and, you know, I use the tissue to apply the insect repellent.
Pretty smart. All right, let's go to Moortown. We've got Tom calling in. Hi, Tom. Go right ahead.
Morning. Interesting show.
Thanks.
I got a little input with the kind of looking for some information on it. I go around in the spring and take a spray can of the cheap like vegetable oil or whatever, and I spray in the old tires, and I spray in all those wet areas to put a coating over the water. I'm guessing that's going to be effective from keeping the mosquitoes from laying their eggs in there, or if the eggs are already in there, that they won't hatch. Is that, am I doing anything right?
Craig, Tom on to something there?
Yes, he is, yeah.
Well,
so that's, there are surfactant films that prevent mosquitoes from being able to merge. And I've not heard of using vegetable oil. I think that's a brilliant idea. Tires are really a huge issue and for container breeding mosquitoes. They do really well. They'll even winter over in tire piles. And tires are, it's one of the things that we're trying to address in the state, is to get a better handle on how we manage tires and reduce mosquito habitat as a result of tires. But no, I think you're doing fine. You're using a non-toxic product. And but again, you know, when you can tip those things and drain them, all the better.
All right, tip and drain. But well done, Tom. Use the vegetable oil like you're doing as well. Great way to keep those numbers down. Craig, are some people more prone to attracting mosquitoes than others?
Yes. Unfortunately, there is some science behind that. And particularly people with blood O types. And it seems like people with O-type blood seems to be more attracted to more of a mosquito magnet. But, you know, mosquitoes are attracted to our carbon dioxide, what we exhale. And, of course, we're releasing toxins through our skin, and we release lactic acid through our skin, which is also an attractant to mosquitoes. And so, you know, it's, and some people will, you know, exude more of that than others. And there are some people that are more attracted or will attract the mosquitoes more.
And on the opposite side, I saw something, it mentioned Skeeter syndrome that a person had. Do some people have more serious reactions to mosquito bites than others, like bee bites?
Yeah, I've not heard anything recently, but I know as a child, you know, growing up in the Poconos of Pennsylvania, I welted up really, really bad. I had pretty serious reactions, and I look back at those days and I just wonder what the species of mosquito I was being bitten by, because it was pretty painful. Like I said, I would just have these huge, you know, quarter size welts on my skin.
I spent many happy summers up at Lake Wallenpaupack in the Poconos. So.
Oh, yeah. I learned how to water ski there.
Oh, excellent. All right. We're going to go back to the phones, this time to Randolph, and we're going to hear from Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hey, good morning, Rick, morning. And good morning to your guests there. I was just reading this morning on the computer that mosquitoes, actually they say, I guess scientifically, that 60% of mosquitoes do not like sage. So, you know, if you're out there camping and you can bring some sage with you to kind of burn, it'll just create like a smoke screen, and apparently they won't like it.
One more reason to love sage. Craig, have you heard that?
No, but, you know, that wouldn't surprise me. I know that when I'm in my vegetable garden, I have a huge sage plant, and sometimes I'll actually rub it on my skin just because I like the scent of it while I'm out there. And I do notice that I'm not affected by mosquitoes in that moment. So that's possible. I mean, citronella is another one, citronella plants. I know that, you know, people go camping and they bring a potted citronella that they put out, you know, right, by their picnic table.
Craig, tell us about the work of the Lemon Fair Insect Control District.
Yeah, thank you. So we are made up of three towns. We're a nonprofit, and it's Cornwall, Weybridge, and Bridport. Our sole responsibility is to really knock down nuisance mosquitoes that would arise in the floodplain of the Lemon Fair River as it runs through these three towns, and also the Cornwall Swamp, which is actually part of the Otter Creek watershed. And so it requires a lot of surveillance, because what we want to be doing is we want to be out there looking for that first hatch, that next hatch of mosquitoes, So we're looking for these really, really tiny larvae swimming in cups of water. And then we determine a threshold by which we would do a treatment. And we treat with a product called BTI, which is a bacterium that's naturally found in soils. It's Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis. The bacterium is impregnated onto crushed corn husks, and that's either applied by hand, or if we have large enough acreage, if we have upwards of 1,000 acres, we'll hire a third party to come in and actually apply it by air via helicopter, and we'll treat those larger acreages with a BTI product. The BTI is ingested by the mosquito larva and creates a hole in the lining of the esophagus through a crystal that's formed from ingesting the product. And the mosquito will continue to feed, but the food never gets into the abdomen, and it doesn't complete its life cycle. One of the beautiful things about BTI is it targets black flies and mosquitoes.
Wow.
When we go out to do our post-treatment surveys, we're always looking for those other aquatic invertebrates to make sure that the environment is still intact. So the beetle larva, the dragonfly and damselfly, naiads, the copepods, which also, all of these things actually feed on mosquito larvae as well and help benefit us. So, but it's really important in post-treatment surveys to be able to observe the effectiveness of the product and seeing a knockdown of mosquito numbers. We never knock everything down, and nor do we want to. We recognize the value and the importance of them in the environment.
Greg, we got about 30 seconds, but you're having an open house for mosquitoes or about mosquitoes. Tell us quickly about that.
Yes, thank you. So July 24th, from 9 in the morning till 2 p.m., we're located behind the Weybridge Congregational Church on Route 23, also known as Weybridge Road. And we'll have a microscope set up. You'll get to look at mosquitoes and be wowed by their oddness. I think they would be, in male mosquitoes under the microscope, would be inspiration for Mummer's Day costumes. they're just the headdresses on these things are just pretty amazing. And then there's a beautiful mosquito called Uranotania sapphirina. And oftentimes when women look at that, through the microscope, they would say, oh, I'd wear that as jewelry, which is hard to imagine, you know. So, but there's some, really beautiful and fascinating things. And, of course, we can share more information and have other things to show you here at the lab.
All right. Craig Zondag is a field specialist biologist for the Lemon Fair Insect Control District. To learn more about their work and the upcoming open house on July 24th, you can visit lficd.org. Craig, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Rick, thank you so much, and thank you for your callers.
All right. I'm going to have to explain to everybody what Mummer's Day is because of the reference you made. All right. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Calvin Cutler of WCAX will be here to preview what's happening with the legislature's veto override session tomorrow. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Now it's time to get an idea of what's happening in the legislature. I know. You thought a few weeks ago that was the end of the citizen legislature for the year, but whenever the governor breaks out the veto pen, it means that there's the possibility of a special session to see if those vetoes can be overridden, and that's what will be happening starting tomorrow. Here to give us an idea of the what's and the why's is the WCAX Capital Bureau Chief, Calvin Cutler. Calvin, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great having you. And listeners, as most of you know, we have the pleasure of hearing from Calvin on a daily basis on the afternoon news service. And if you'd like to get a question in for Calvin about the special session or about anything that's happened in the recently concluded session, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Just keep in mind that Calvin didn't vote yay or nay on any of those bills. He simply reports on them, right, Calvin?
That is true. Just reporting the process and the policy, for sure.
That's the way to do it. All right, what would you say typified the session of the legislature just finished?
Yeah, I think, you know, by and large, it was really, of course, defined by the pandemic and really moving, hundreds of millions of dollars of federal cash that we got from the American Rescue Plan. It's really remarkable. In any given year, you know, lawmakers would be debating on how do we spend $10,000 here, $100,000 here, $50,000 there. But now, you know, really all of those discussions were smoothed over because of this huge influx of federal cash. I mean, there were a few, policy disagreements here and there, and there was some work that, you know, lawmakers tried to take up regarding the state's unfunded pension liability funds. But that will, of course, be pushed to next session. So I would say that was sort of the defining theme of what happened. But there was a lot of work that went on bill-wise that really wasn't necessarily related to the pandemic as well.
Yeah, I had wondered, our legislature tends to be more collegial than most anyway. But with so much of that extra federal cash around, kind of does make things, it greases the wheels a little bit, doesn't it, for democracy?
It does, yeah, and I think, you know, people really were able to set aside party, last session, of course, with the pandemic, but also this session, too. You know, I think there's wide agreement, you know, between the House and Senate and the governor's team as well of how these funds should be spent, you know, investing in, you know, water, sewer, broadband. You know, those aren't really controversial, topics, but once you start kind of getting down into the nitty-gritty of, you know, how exactly should the money be spent and, you know, what should these programs look like? I think you get a little disagreement there. But, you know, by and large, it was a very smooth session, even though, as you mentioned, you know, we did have several bills that the governor vetoed.
Yeah. What were the most noteworthy bills that did pass this session?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the budget being the big one. I mean, that one had, you know, that was over a $7 billion budget that had, you know, investments in, you know, human capital and broadband, over $150 million for broadband as well. And then, of course, there was a, you know, universal mail-out ballot system as well. For every general election, there's going to be, we're going to be repeating the same process that we had, mailing ballots to every registered voter. So I think those are two big ones. For me as well. But I mean, there was also a child care bill, which really looks to bolster the child care workforce and expand that to as many, you know, low income families as we can. So certainly really, really big investments this year, only possible from the American Rescue Plan funds.
Was the inability to craft legislation on a plan for the pension fund shortfalls a major failure?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say it was a failure. I think it was a pretty big setback for, you know, Democrats in the House. They were really the ones taking the lead on it. It was kind of an awkward position to be caught in because, the Vermont Teachers Association and the State Employees Association, traditionally they're, you know, big supporters of Democratic candidates. And so as a refresher, that plan really would have, slashed retirement benefits. People would have to pay more into the system and they would receive less. But of course, you know, it's all in an effort to fix our $3 billion shortfall that we're seeing in the pension funds. And that's going to affect everyone. So there's going to be some hard choices that are going to have to be made in next session. They punted it to a summer study committee,
right,
this session, but they'll be picking that work up, in January.
And Calvin, before we dig into the veto session, how easy or difficult was it for you covering this virtual version of the session?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think whether you're in the press or, you know, you're a lobbyist or even if you're a lawmaker, too, I mean, I think it was a real challenge for people to, you know, communicate and to have access to each other. It's interesting because they live streamed the committee hearings in the House and Senate on YouTube, which really opened up the process, and sometimes thousands of people were watching these meetings. But then at the same time, if you want to be able to interact and ask questions and get, you know, clarifying points, you can't pull people out into the hallway or meet them in the cafeteria like you could in years past. So I think, you know, from a reporting standpoint, that was certainly a challenge. But, you know, I think lawmakers kind of shared that frustration. But again, you know, the state had to do what we had to do to keep the spread of COVID-19 at bay.
Absolutely. And it seemed to have gone pretty smoothly, all things considered. Let's look at the bills now that were vetoed by Governor Phil Scott. Two of the three are quite similar, the non-resident voting bills. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so these were charter changes that were passed in Montpelier and Winooski. The thought process behind the bills was basically we have people in these communities, they live here, they pay taxes, they shop at our businesses, they attend our schools, so they should be able to vote in local elections, and not state or federal elections. These were pretty popular charter changes in these communities, and of course, when those pass in individual municipalities, the legislature, by way of our constitution, has to approve them as well. So it was in Montpelier and in Winooski, the legislature passed them, and the governor vetoed them. Basically, you know, the governor said that he wasn't opposed to the idea, but he said that if we need to do this as a state, we can't do it in a piecemeal approach. We have to, you know, not town by town. It has to be a statewide policy for non-citizens to be able to vote.
And, yeah, these are non-U.S. citizens who do live in these towns. People in both cities voted kind of overwhelmingly to allow to have them vote on not state, what would they be able to vote on? Just local issues? Is that what it is?
Yeah, local issues, select boards, special elections, that type of thing. I believe in Winooski they would have been able to vote on school budgets as well. And I think, you know, there was a little hesitation on the governor's side from that, because once you start voting on school budgets, it kind of gets into, you know, the property tax and mill rate. But that aside, it's basically just local elections, no state or federal elections.
And the key here is it's a charter change. So explain why this has to go then to the legislature and the governor, even though it passed in each of these two cities.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and Vermont is kind of a quirky state in the fact that, you know, if you want to pass something on the local municipal level or a charter change, it has to go through the legislature. And because of that, you know, whether we're talking non-citizen voting or we're talking about, you know, gun laws, which passed back in Burlington a few years ago, all of these changes have to go through the legislature so we don't have an inconsistency in laws where, you know, let's just say in one town, you may be following the law and following that local ordinance or a charter change, but then you go over to the next town over and, you know, you might accidentally, inadvertently be breaking the law. So that's sort of the process and why we have to have charter changes go through the legislature.
There has been that rub about charter changes going through the legislature. It seems to be really frustrating local municipalities. Any talk of that getting to change, and what would that take?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it really brings back the age-old debate of, you know, to what degree should towns be able to write and enforce their own laws? And, you know, Vermont is something we call a Dillon state, basically meaning that, you know, the legislature ultimately has control over it. I think opinion at the state house is pretty split on this because, you know, it does help to have individual towns making their own policies. But, you know, again, it kind of depends on the policy. It depends on the issue. That would have to go through the, you know, subsequent government operations committees, really for that sort of reform to happen. So I think, you know, it's an age old debate, and I don't necessarily see any action happening on that, at least in the next session, second half of the biennium. But, you know, it's really been kicked around for quite a few years now.
Yeah. We're getting a preview of the special legislative session starting tomorrow on the, to vote on trying to override three vetoes by Governor Phil Scott. Calvin, the third bill has to do with juvenile records. What exactly would that bill have done?
Yeah, so this one, basically, you know, this stems off of, you know, a fatal crash that happened in Charlotte last year. But basically, you know, information about people who are under 20 years old that commit crimes, they would be exempt from press releases and from, you know, the public's, you know, being in the public sphere and having their name published. The idea behind it is basically it's, you know, continuing to reform Vermont's youthful offender laws, and where, you know, somebody, if they're, let's just say 18 or 19, some, you know, they commit a crime, their name is published in the press. And of course, you know, today with social media and you know, websites and the internet, you know, that name never goes away. And that can have really big implications for people later in life trying to get a job or take out a loan or that sort of thing. So the idea behind it was, you know, to really protect people and protect young offenders. But of course, you know, the governor, he vetoed that bill, basically saying that the state really hasn't done enough on the back end to continue to support young offenders. You know, we're continuing to raise the age, you know, of how people should be, or when people should be held responsible. But the governor argues that, you know, we haven't set up, you know, housing programs, you know, substance use programs, diversion programs, more social service programs on the back end that really a lot of these people would instead be attending. So that was the governor's thinking. And then, of course, you know, the press really pushed back on this one as well. You know, of course, as I mentioned, it would exempt names from press releases. And so, you know, for a lot of, you know, people in the Vermont media, you know, it raises the question of, you know, does the public have the right to know if somebody's 18, 19 years old, they can legally drive, they can enlist in the military, you know, does the public have the right to know? So it's definitely a balance. And that's the other one that, you know, Democrats in the legislature will try to override.
Okay. Did I miss anybody, any vetoes before I move on?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, basically just the big takeaway is, it's veto sessions aren't necessarily rare, but I mean, certainly it's a really it's probably one of the most political processes that you can go through. I mean, there's a lot of backroom discussions and, you know, testing party loyalty, you know, who's going to, you know, stick with the governor, who's going to vote to override. You know, it's there's a lot of lobbying that goes on in the days leading up to a veto session. So, of course, that's complicated this year. Everything's being done over Zoom, but that's pretty much the big takeaway there.
So this will be a virtual session starting tomorrow?
It will, yep. So it's going to be virtual starting tomorrow, and it'll run through Thursday. They will also, you know, it's kind of a complex process, but they will also be taking up another bill that wasn't actually voted on. Before having to do with, you know, rental housing and, you know, a statewide registry as well.
All right. Let's take a call from Rich, who's joining us from Starksboro. Hi, Rich. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. Good morning, Colin. I have a question. I think you just began to start to address the question. The bill I'm asking about is H-157 that requires residential contractors to register if they, I guess the Senate version is $2,500 and the House version is $3,500 of building expenses. Do you expect them to, is that the one you expect them to take up? And do you, what do you think about it's coming to an agreement and concurring with each other to pass it?
Calvin?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, they will be taking up that bill probably tomorrow before they start voting on, you know, the veto overrides. And, you know, I guess just a little bit of background. This one basically allocates, you know, some $5 million to beef up housing stock and gives landlords, you know, grants up to $30,000 to really renovate apartments. And it also creates a loan fund for first time home buyers as well. And the controversial part of this is, you know, Republicans pushed back on this right before the end of the session, but it also would create a central statewide database of rental units, you know, with the idea of regulation and making them safe and, you know, having fire and sewer and water codes. You know, as I mentioned, Republicans were opposed to it, and they said that it was an example of government overreach. But Democrats say that they will pick it up, and they are confident that they can push this over the finish line this week. So I think there will be movement on that, and I think that will pass.
Calvin, the Vermont Legislative Joint Fiscal Office estimates that it's going to cost the state between $30,000 and $40,000 per day for this session. If it's virtual, where's, you know, that seems like a high ticket amount. Is it a per diem amount that gets paid to the representatives and the senators? Where does that figure come from?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of that, of course, there's funding legislative staff, people, you know, working in the state house. You're right, you know, lawmakers, they do get stipends as well, although the legislature has reclaimed some of them this year because, you know, they haven't had to drive from Brattleboro to Montpelier or that sort of thing. So that's really where a lot of the money comes from. And then there's also, you know, technical fees of like, okay, you know, for streaming and, you know, keeping the lights on in the state house, that type of thing, even though nobody's there. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, bring up a good point. A lot of people have questioned, you know, why are we having this now? You know, why not just wait until January? And I think for the Montpelier and Winooski charter changes, you know, Democrats in the legislature have said that we need to vote on these now. That way those municipalities can prepare for the 2022 general election. So that's sort of the urgency and why they're, you know, pushing these bills through the or engaging in this process right now.
How many votes are needed, Calvin, to override these vetoes?
So it takes a two-third majority in the House and Senate to override vetoes. For all three bills, the Winooski, Montpelier, and the juvenile records bill, senators say that they have the votes to override all three. But in the House, it's a little bit more unclear. You know, the Montpelier charter change, that passed 103-39, so that shouldn't be a problem for them. But the Winooski charter change was 99-44. So, you know, that one we'll have to see really how it goes, if they're able to swing a vote or two. And then the juvenile records bill, that one passed with 88 votes in the House. So I think if they wanted to overturn that veto, there's going to be a lot of lobbying and a lot of discussions. And I think, you know, leading up to it, especially the independent caucus as well, you know, people who are registered as an independent in the state house, there's a lot of, you know, leaning on them and, you know, trying to outreach and saying, hey, here's why you should vote to override or vote to sustain. So it'll be interesting leading up to Thursday when they have those votes.
And is that two-thirds of those in attendance for this session?
Correct. Yep, two-thirds in attendance. And it's worth mentioning, too, the juvenile bill, you know, it passed 88, but there were a considerable number of absences as well in the House when that passed.
All right. And we do have coming up this morning another of Governor Phil Scott's COVID-19 response news conferences. And I think, Calvin, that you have – is it a perfect 100% that you've been there in time to ask the very first question at these sessions?
I wish I could say my attendance was 100%, but I think out of the 130-140, I forget how many we've had now, but I've only missed one throughout the course of the pandemic. I know, I wish I could say I had a perfect attendance, but to be fair, I think Governor Scott might have not attended one. I believe it was on Election Day last year.
That's
so,
right.
You know, it's, who knows?
All right, so you're as good as the gov, and it's always great. They start with Calvin. He's there in attendance to ask that very first question. Calvin, this was very informative. I really appreciate it. Calvin Cutler is the WCAX Capital Bureau Chief. Really great having you on the program this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, take care. We're going to break for CBS News and then return to learn about something refreshing called Shrubly. And a reminder that the Sox back in action tonight. They open a three-game series in Florida against the Tampa Bay Rays. WDEV coverage begins at 6:10. First pitch from the Trop, 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Yesterday at this time, Will Rapp was on to discuss his plans for Nordic Farm in Charlotte. At one point, he mentioned a Vermont product called Shrubly, which I had never heard of before. He said it used Aronia, which I had never heard of before. I was this close to just shutting down the show to rush out and learn more about both. Wisely, I came to my senses and waited until the end of the program to learn new things so that you could learn some new things today. One of the greatest things about the next interview is that I'm going to get to say the word shrubly a lot, and I'm going to be out in front of the pronunciation of Aronia. I still don't know if I'm saying acai right. A-C-A-I? I have no idea. Here to clear everything up is the person who brought Shrubly into this world, Matt Sayre. Matt, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Eric, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Matt, or if you've had a Shrubly already, give us a call, 244-1777, or toll-free, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right. Matt, when I think of a shrub, I think of something ornamental to decorate a lawn. But what is another definition for shrub as it relates to beverages?
It's kind of a silly name for a beverage, and that's what I thought the first time I came across it. I actually had my first shrub drink at Lunig's on Church Street for a lunch meeting that I was at while working at UVM one day, and I wanted to have a refreshing non-alcoholic drink, and that was what was on the menu. So I remember ordering it then, and that was my first exposure to what a shrub is. And shrubs date back to the 15th century, and historically they were a popular way to preserve fruit. So as there was a time before refrigeration when fruit would spoil, so what people did was they put fruit into vinegar, and it became a fruit-infused vinegar. That vinegar was sometimes sweetened slightly with honey and other things like maple syrup and sugars, and it became known as a shrub mixer that was featured in colonial cocktail recipes. I don't want to try to pronounce the original source of where the word comes from. I believe it's pronounced shrub, but it is what the word or the frozen treat known as, I think, sherbet is the way to say that, came from. It's all based on the same word. So shrub was our American colonial way of referring to this drink. And in about 2012, a farm in Pennsylvania, I think, deserves the credit for rediscovering shrubs and bringing those back to America. So since then, mixologists have been using shrubs to make really refreshing cocktails and non-alcoholic mocktails, and we discovered it through that and some work we're doing here at our small dairy farm, and we're excited to kind of continue to innovate with shrub as the core of our beverage line.
Yeah, so shrubs in the colonial days, we leap forward a couple centuries to what you're doing now. It's called Shrubly. So what is that?
Well, Shrubly is a lightly sparkling, ready-to-drink, functional beverage with bold flavor from the old-time mixer that we were just talking about called a shrub. It's made in small batches with organic fruit from our little Vermont berry farm, herbs, spices, apple cider vinegar, and other wellness shot ingredients.
The name makes me so happy. Who and how was that struck upon? Who came up with that?
Well, it actually goes back to my wife, who was making, taking an apple cider vinegar shot daily just for health. And we had a small berry farm that we were trying to determine what the best way to use the berries that we grow would be. And we decided to add our aronia berries to that in the form of juice to make it even more palatable and healthy. So it started out really as that wellness shot. And then when I came across the shrub mixer out at lunch that day, I thought, well, that was refreshing. It was too sweet for me, the one that I had there, and decided to try to make our own shrub with the berries that we grow. And when we made that, we ended up using it mostly at home to put into water to be something other than water to drink with our family. And then a lot of times we were adding it just a carbonated water seltzer, plain seltzer, and even a little bit flavored seltzer. So we're taking our aronia berry shrub, that was the shrub we first came up with, and making a healthy beverage that our whole family could enjoy as an alternative to, you know, sodas and things like that. We have three girls, young girls, and we wanted them to be able to enjoy some sophisticated sparkling beverages, and we ended up referring to it as shrubly, because we're essentially taking our shrub and combining it with bubbly. So shrub plus bubbly equals shrubly.
Oh, excellent. Now, as a business, how long has this been happening at the Sayre home, and how long have you been working on shrubly as a business idea?
Well, over a decade ago, we decided that we wanted to move out to the country. We were living in Burlington and loved our community in Burlington and had a very happy life there with two young girls at that point. And we saw them come alive every time we went out to the country and spent time in more open spaces. So we really wanted to move out to the country. And I had also been working at the University of Vermont, and still am, on educational programs focused on the food system. So I was learning a lot about the food system and sustainable food enterprises, and felt that one way that I could help promote sustainability and help strengthen our community would be to create a small farm that used the land in a productive way. So started that search over a decade ago, and it took a long time to find something that we could afford. And fortunately, after a long search, we found a small piece of property here in Hinesburg, and that was thanks to the hard work of the Hinesburg Land Trust, who had worked with a local farm nearby to preserve this land or conserve this land. And we, through a competitive process, put in a proposal and were selected to start a small farm here. And our idea was to grow fruit and to create a value-added product from the fruit that we grow. But at that point, we weren't sure what we would produce. And we're open to different ideas. And over time, we came across the aronia berry and made our way forward. A funny thing about that process, I just was recalling as I was telling you, was looking at land with with an extension agent, as I was really afraid to make this step, but it felt like the right step for our family. And my wife also agreed that if we could find the right piece of property and the right community, that we'd end up being able to follow that dream and make an even better life potentially for our family. And I remember I was at one piece of land not far from here, actually, that I think it's still available. And we were out in the field and we were looking over the land, and this extension agent was taking soil samples and things like that. And at one point he looked over at me and he said, "Oh, are you all right? You're all red." And I had broken out in hives. I never had hives in my entire life. And I was so stressed. I was so worried about disrupting this, you know, life that my family had and making a crazy choice. And that I think that stress just got to me. And you know, I didn't know anything, even though I studied the food system and sustainability, and I had been helping through the educational programs that I developed, others understand aspects of the food system. Mm-hmm. This was all new to me, and it was really a big leap that we're taking. So we didn't end up getting that piece of land, and ended up coming over here not far down the road and finding this one, and I feel like we were landed in the perfect place. And again, it was all because of the hard work that people in this community had done to conserve this special place that we feel like we're very fortunate to be here and acting as stewards of this land.
And Matt, can I assume you haven't broken out in hives anytime in the past few years?
Not since then. I mean, I have had some stressful moments, but I haven't had any hives.
All right, Matt, let's see now. What flavors of Shrubly do you make?
Shrubly currently comes in two flavors, lemon ginger and aronia berry, and then aronia berry and pomegranate.
And how do you make it?
We have other flavors.
Oh, you have other flavors. Go ahead.
Well, when we first introduced the product, it was introduced just before the pandemic on 2/20/20 was the date we had Shrubly on shelves here at our local market, Lantman's, and some other markets and cafes. And when we introduced it, we did have other flavors, but it's difficult to have the resources when you're a startup, especially during a pandemic, to be able to have too many SKUs. So we scaled back to the two flavors that I just mentioned, which were selling the best. But the other two flavors had some very strong fans that would like us to reintroduce those, and we do plan to offer other flavors over time, and we'll bring those back when we have the resources to do so.
All right. Tease us with the other two flavors as well.
We had a blueberry, elderflower, and ginger was one of the flavors, and the other was strawberry, lemon, and black currant. And we actually also grow a small number of black currants around the property, so that was made with black currants from our own little farm.
How do you produce? How do you make this Shrubly?
Shrubly is made in small batches in Williston, Vermont. And so going all the way back to the farm, we harvest the aronia berries in September each year. We harvest those directly into food-grade 5-gallon pails and transport them immediately to Williston the same day that we pick those, where they're placed into a freezer. The freezing process actually helps concentrate the sugars and breaks down the skins a little bit on the aronia berries themselves. So those then are used to pressed, and the juice from that is combined with ginger, which is actually also sourced as whole ginger and pressed at this facility. Mm. And the not every one of our shrub beverages uses ginger, but that's one of the ingredients that is brought in by the A Drop of Joy is the name of the production facility where we have it made. But every shrub is made around one core ingredient, which is, for us, apple cider vinegar. All shrubs use a vinegar of some sort. We have chosen to use apple cider vinegar for its exceptional health benefits. And the fruit, herbs, spices are combined with the apple cider vinegar, and then that is added to carbonated water and canned or bottled right in Williston, Vermont.
Well, now we've got to talk about the berry. We've been kind of dancing around, and that is this aronia. What is aronia?
Aronia berries are very similar in appearance to blueberries. So many people, when they drive by on the dirt road past our farm here, say, oh, you're growing blueberries, and they're about the same size. But then I have a side conversation as I'm trying to weed, and I love people's interest, and I'm happy to talk about them. They are a berry that, although they look like blueberries, they're not quite as plump and not quite as sweet. Some people do like to eat them right off the bush, and most people don't prefer them that way. They prefer them processed in some way. Peroni berries have been shown in some studies to contain about 5 times the antioxidants per serving of blueberries or cranberries. So it's a super healthy berry. You know, some people use the word superfruit, and
right.
this could be considered one of those. We actually sourced our aronia plants from a study that was being done by the University of Connecticut and the University of Maine when we were first trying to learn about different options for growing crops here. I knew that I wanted a specialty fruit, but I wasn't sure exactly which plants to grow, and that we came across that study, attended a workshop, and acquired the plants from those. And the aronia has been studied not only for its resilience to pests and the productivity. It can be a very productive, sustainable crop to grow, but also because it's been shown to help fight conditions like cancer, diabetes, and more. So it's a very healthy berry to consume. And I guess I'd just encourage people to Google A-R-O-N-I-A is how you spell it. So I won't have to go on and on about all the benefits.
All right. That's a great idea. Check out aronia. So how easy is it, Matt, to let people know about what Shrubly is exactly?
How easy is it to know?
Yeah,
to know?
Because it's definitely a different type of beverage than anybody's used to.
Yeah, we're actually, in some ways, think we're introducing a new beverage category.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sparkling shrub. And so shrub mixers have been around for a while since, well, hundreds of years ago, but then came back into popularity around 2012. And Shrubly, as a beverage, taking the shrub and combining it with sparkling water, is something that is brand new. And we feel that there's a lot of opportunity to create different types of products with the shrub, the sparkling shrub, as the core of that. And when we're trying to explain what Shrubly is, people ask about other types of beverages like switchel and mm-hmm. things that have apple cider vinegar in those. And those other beverages are, I enjoy drinking those as well. And we try not to use a lot of sweetener in ours. So, and we have very low sugars or no sugars and very low calories. So we have made a functional beverage that is hopefully something people will drink because they enjoy its taste, but is also something that they'll receive benefits from the healthy ingredients that we've chosen to use to make Shrubly.
How have you been distributing Shrubly?
We have a distributor here in Vermont, and we distribute throughout the state of Vermont with that one distributor, and we also have another small distributor along the New England seacoast. Mm. And that area we selected because that distributor not only distributes the products, but they also can make it for us. And we want all of the product here in Vermont made in Vermont, so that way it is hyper-local. So we grow and make it very close to where it's consumed. When we wanted to extend outside of Vermont, I wanted that same thing to be true. So although we grow the fruit here, and we transport them there, and then it's made very locally to where it's distributed there. We do hope to scale up, and we'll have opportunities to figure out how to continue to make it as local product and sustainably sourced product as possible over time. But we need additional resources to continue to scale up, and for now it's really just a New England-based beverage.
Wow. Now, during the pandemic, did you have to do some of the distributing yourself?
Well, we started with just a couple markets and cafes, and it was selling very well the month before everything shut down. And then we had a bunch of products sitting in a warehouse in Williston, and we had to figure out how to keep selling it. And at the same time, my 15-year-old daughter had gotten her permit, so I thought, this is a great opportunity to distribute direct to people's doorsteps and have her learn how to drive. So she was the driver and I was the teacher, and we were the Shrubly distributors together. So that was a great experience, and a lot of work, a lot of time, but the community was so supportive. So they kept us going and were able to sell through all that product that was in the warehouse. And just in that process, because it was selling well, Feral Distributing, which wasn't necessarily looking for new non-alcoholic beverage brands to distribute during a pandemic, they were supportive of Shrubly and really wanted to help us succeed. So I'm very grateful for them taking on Shrubly during that time. And since then, we've stopped doing self-distribution like that, and Feral has taken over and is doing a great job.
And does your daughter have her license? Did she get all the Shrubly to the end, you know, the destination safely?
She did, and she earned her license, and she actually now is this summer, her summer job is helping do sales, so you'll see her out and about. We have a nice branded tent that we're at different events, and we're posting those on our Instagram site, which is Shrubly, and then also our website, shrubly.com, and she'll be at the different stores and markets and cafes where Shrubly is sold, and those are also listed on a store locator, which is on our website as well. So you'll have a chance to meet her, hopefully, as she's out and about, and it's just so heartwarming to have not only, you know, the support of the family, but the community has really been so supportive of Shrubly and our little farm here, and we couldn't have done it without people caring enough to help in ways that they could.
Matt, we have about 30 seconds left. Do you have any other ideas for products that Shrubly will be making in the future?
So many ideas, but we're staying focused on our core line. However, we have been asked quite a bit to make canned cocktails, and we're working on a canned cocktail at this point, and we hope to be able to find the resources to offer that in the near future.
Oh, that sounds exciting. I shouldn't get so pumped up, but I did kind of gasp when I heard that. Matt Sayre is owner of Shrubly. You can learn more at their website, shrubly.com. Matt, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thank you. I really appreciate you taking time to share a little bit about Shrubly and talk with me today.
All right. And Aronia, a lot of fun there. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we're going to return to hear all about Vermont High School Rodeo. And don't forget, we got the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up this morning at 11 o'clock here on WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. About a decade ago, I was driving through Castleton, and I saw these lawn signs promoting rodeo on Saturday nights at Pond Hill Ranch. What? Rodeo? This has been going on there for around 50 years. I stopped out on a rainy Saturday evening and saw 2,000 rodeo fans enjoying the evening's events. Then yesterday, during the party calendar, I learned that there's high school rodeo in Vermont. I had no idea. Joining me now to fill us in on what this is all about is Mindy Wolliver of the Vermont High School Rodeo Association. Welcome, Mindy.
Hi.
Hi. Madison Morris is with us, one of the athletes. Madison, thanks for being here.
Of course.
And Hope Gaborio, another competitor as well. Thank you, Hope, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have a question about high school rodeo in Vermont, or maybe you've participated, you can join us by calling 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mindy, what is the Vermont High School Rodeo Association?
Well, I started the high school rodeo
for kids to be able to have something to do other than sit at home and to be able to be part of something bigger and that involves animals. And what it is kids in the grades 5th through 12th graders can join. And there's barrel racing, pole bending, bronc riding, bull riding, calf roping, anything you would normally see at a regular rodeo, we teach the kids from ages, or grades, 5 to 12.
How long has this been going on?
High school rodeo has been around for a really long time. And we just started it. I started getting it going in January, and we were finally able to take participants come March.
Okay, good. I feel like I've never heard of it before, but it's not been around so long that I'm an idiot. So how many schools or students are involved right now?
Right now we have 10 active riders, several that are in the process of signing up. The girls have nationals come next month, and they're from almost every state in the U.S. and Canada and Alaska. And there's a couple others that are overseas that are a part of it also. And there's going to be well over, 15,000 people.
Oh, my. So, Madison, how long have you been doing rodeo? What got you started in it?
I started learning how to do rodeo when I was really young. I started riding off and on when I was around 4. And I just recently got into rodeo about 3 years ago. And definitely just having the opportunity that a lot of other kids don't have to be able to do this and wanting to make a career out of it.
Hope, how about you? When did you start and what got you interested in rodeo?
I only started about 7 months ago, but I just saw how much fun it was, and having a connection with a horse like that, it's really awesome.
Have you done other equestrian events like dressage or show jumping or anything before?
No.
No kidding, just riding.
Yeah.
All right. And Madison, what do you enjoy most about doing rodeo?
The adrenaline, 100%. I love it. Going through the gate, not listening to anything else, it's amazing.
Wow. So you're sitting there, and then, like, all of a sudden, what happens? Is there, like, a bell, and the gate opens, and off you go?
They call your name, or they call your number. Normally, they do a draw. So they'll call your name, and they'll say, Madison Morris is on deck, and Hope Gaborio is in the hole. So the person that's running goes in and they run, and then I'm on deck, so I'm waiting for them to come out, and then I go in and run, and then when I'm done, Hope goes in and runs.
Wow, and Hope, how often can you train, especially like in the winter months in Vermont?
In the winter, there's not much we could do with a lot of snow, but we train, if there's places that we can train, like indoor arenas, we go there and train, so maybe like twice a month.
Mm-hmm. Mindy, is rodeo an approved sport by the VPA yet?
I do believe so, but I would definitely have to double check. We have really strict rules. Our horses have to be vetted. Nothing that we can use or do can be harmful to the horse, such as like spiky spurs. We just have so many laws and regulations that we have to go by. And the high school rodeo for nationals, they get it set up through all of the states, and you have to abide by their rules. And every horse has to be in perfect condition with no issues in order to even run. If it looks like they even have a cough, they don't allow it.
So you want safety for both riders and for the animals involved as well?
Absolutely. They have the highest standards for animal care and riders.
So the Vermont High School Rodeo Association, is there one big event? Or, you know, what kind of event do you have with your association here in Vermont?
Well, last month we did our state finals, which got the girls qualified for nationals. And we put on our own events. We're going to be having an event coming up that we're offering people that are not part of high school rodeo to do barrel racing and pole bending against our girls that are going to nationals, and just so they can have a little bit of an idea of what it is we do. And then we also, I have an event coming up July 11th for a lady that I care for that has disabilities. I do riding lessons with, and her friends are going to be doing an event here at my house. So we try to get out there and get the community to see what it is we're doing and see what the kids are learning. And everybody has been amazing about it.
So one event is July 11th. What the first event, do you know when that is?
Our tentative date is going to be when we are back from Nationals. Nationals goes from the 17th to the 24th of July. So it's probably going to be the last week. The last weekend in July is our plan.
All right. Madison, I've been to two rodeos in my life, in Sacramento, California, and in Castleton, Vermont. So I'm no expert. Please explain what barrel racing is all about.
So barrel racing is a cloverleaf pattern, and you start at the gate, and as soon as you cross a timer, that's when your time starts, and you're trying to get through the pattern in under 18 seconds. So you go up and around the first barrel if you're going to the right or the left, and you come around that, and you go to the second one, and it's exactly like a cloverleaf pattern, and you try to not hit or knock over the barrels, and if you do, it's a 5-second penalty.
What's your best time?
Mine would be 16.8 on my pattern.
Wow, that's really fantastic. Why did you choose this sport, barrel racing?
I started working with horses when I was really young, and I just really loved it. And I'd always go on social media, and I'd see all of the famous barrel racers like Haley Kinzel or Lisa Lockhart or Steely Steiner, and I wanted to be exactly like them when I was younger.
How important is the horse to performing well in this event?
Oh, 1,000%. If you do not have a healthy horse, it's not going to run at top speeds or condition. You have to take unbelievable care of that animal. And having a huge partnership or bond with that animal is so important.
So if the horse is 1,000%, are you saying I could be on top of the horse and still do a 16.8 cloverleaf?
Absolutely.
Oh, come on. All right, Madison, tell us about your horse. What's its name? What kind of horse is it?
His name is Twister. He is a 8-year-old appendix gelding, and he is all white, so it's kind of hard to keep him clean, but, you know, we work on it. And we brought him straight out of Illinois. We drove to Ohio in one night to pick him up.
Oh, my.
And it was kind of like a sight unseen, because we hadn't gone and tried him or anything. And we bought him for $3,500, and I don't think I'd trade him for the world.
How long have you been riding Twister?
6 months.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hope, now both you and Madison do this next event, and for the life of me, I have no idea what it is. So please, for all of us, explain what pole bending is.
Okay, so basically it's 6 poles lined up in a straight line, 21 feet apart, and you basically have to weave in between the poles and make it through them as fast as you can.
What's the bending part? Is that you and the horse bending around the poles?
Yeah, pretty much.
Ah, okay. So, can you knock them over? Is that a problem if you would do that, or what happens?
Yeah, if you knock them over, you get time added on to your run, but.
So what is a good time for pole bending?
19 to 20 seconds.
That still seems lightning fast. How good are you at it right now?
Not very good.
But you enjoy it. So what is it that you're enjoying about pole bending and being in the rodeo?
It's honestly just a lot of fun, and working with your horse and getting them to, you know, do what you ask, and your horse is, you know, getting confused, and yeah, just have to basically work through it, and it's just a lot of fun. It's complicated, but
Tell us about your horse. Who is it, and what kind of horse is it?
I actually ride one of Mindy's horses. Her name is Annie Oakley. She's 18 years old. She's a blue roan appy, and she's very lazy.
Well, you'll get her. You'll get her pretty athletic and healthy and moving, and that's pretty great. Mindy, who coaches these rodeo athletes?
We have an amazing coach named Josh Richards. He comes out on Mondays and Saturdays and works with the girls from 4:30 to 6:30, helping them learn how to use their leg pressure and how to tip the nose in when they're turning barrels or the poles, their posture. He has been absolutely amazing. One of our girls, Jenna Bennett, rides for NBHA, and just her coming here for two classes with him, she increased her time around the barrels by a second and a half.
Wow. So how do the athletes pay for the expenses that they have to do rodeo?
Well, we've been doing a lot of fundraising. We have a bottle drive on Saturday at Champlain Farms in Northfield. And I've made a whole bunch of bags and hats and shirts, just gear for the girls to be able to either auction off or sell. We also had the opportunity to sell tickets for nationals where we got to keep a percentage of those tickets, that ticket sales, for a horse trailer, a Weatherby rifle, and a Dodge truck.
So how many are going to nationals?
We have five girls that qualified for nationals this year.
Oh, that's outstanding. Congratulations to all of you. Let's talk a little bit more about the bag and bottle drive at the Champlain Farms in Northfield. That's this Sunday, right? And what are the times?
Yes. From 10 to 6.
10 to 6. All right. And people, please, if you're in the area, you've got bottles, cans that, you know, you don't, you got sitting around. You don't want to have to go to the recycling center. This is a very good cause that you can take it to at the Champlain Farms in Northfield, 10 to 6, and help these young athletes make it to Lincoln, Nebraska. Now, Madison, what year and where are you going to high school?
I go to high school at Northfield High School. And when I started this, I was a freshman. I am now a sophomore.
All right. And have you decided what you want to study in college?
Absolutely. I want to go to Michigan State University, and I would like to study equine therapy and probably do some aquatherapy.
And I did some research, so I think I know why you want to go to Michigan State, other than that great program. They have a rodeo, college rodeo team.
They do. They have an amazing college rodeo.
They do indeed. Wow. So do you think you would do this, that you would continue and try to do it in college?
Absolutely. I would love to make this my career, and I've said this since day one. It's something that is not just a pastime for me. It's something that I would like to make money off of, and I would absolutely love to go pro with it.
Wow, that's fantastic. I will point out that there are 39 that I counted, 39 colleges in the country that are part of the National Intercollegiate Rodeo Association, Michigan State being one of them. Not many east of the Mississippi, some in Kentucky and in the South, but Michigan State is indeed one of those schools. So how about you, Hope? You know, what year are you and where are you going to high school?
I go to high school in Rutland High School, and I'm a junior.
Have you decided if you're going to go on to college and what you want to study?
I want to study phlebotomy.
Wow. And would you look at a school, or are you thinking about going to a school that offers rodeo as well?
I think I would definitely be a lot very interested in doing that.
Wow.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Now, Mindy, did you do rodeo in high school, or have you done rodeo at all?
No. When I was younger, you know, it was a different time, and my rodeo was my dad putting barrels outside in the pasture and saying, go ahead, learn. For me, I didn't have the opportunities that some of the other kids now have. I trained my own horse and did my own thing, and I just did it for fun. And when my daughter started getting into horses and barrel racing, I was like, well, you know, why travel all over the place? Let's see if we can do it here. And then just checking into it turned into actually doing it, which turned into now going to nationals.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, how much money do you need to raise to get everybody, the five competitors, out to Lincoln, Nebraska for those nationals, Mindy?
Well, I actually paid a good chunk out of my own pocket. The riders, their parents have paid a good chunk. But we know that we have to stop at a horse hotel to give the horse a break and out of the trailer. And that's anywhere between $20 to $30 a horse. And then the hotel and the feed and just getting the kids the extra help to be able to have the food and some of that fun stuff that the local kids there, you know, wouldn't have to pay for. And we're looking at hopefully trying to raise at least 5,000.
All right. Again, we'll mention that this Sunday there's a bag and bottle drive that will help these athletes make it to Lincoln. That's 10 to 6 in Northfield at the Champlain Farms. Madison, what does it mean to you to be able to compete at the Nationals in Lincoln, Nebraska?
Oh, my. This is a huge accomplishment for me, especially because I've only been riding this horse for about 5 or 6 months now, and we have just excelled so much. And it's all him. I could not do anything that I'm doing now without him. He carries me everywhere.
And Hope, have you you're headed to nationals. Have you turned up the intensity in training a notch, knowing that you're going to be competing against kids across the country?
I'm actually not going to be competing, but I definitely have turned up the notch on training very much so.
Is it your goal to make it next year?
Definitely, yes.
That's great. Mindy, how do athletes who are interested in getting involved in high school rodeo do so?
Well, they can find us on Facebook or they can call me. They can email me at mindyl21@outlook.com. And I am more than happy to give them the website to be able to sign up. Or if they have questions and just want to get a couple answers, they can also go to www.nationalhighschoolrodeo.com, and it will bring up everything that they have questions about, and it'll give them a state where they can sign up. And how it works is, say somebody in New Hampshire wants to sign up, but they don't offer high school rodeo in New Hampshire, they can come too. So they have their option. New York has it. We now have it. So any surrounding states that don't have it, whoever's closer, they can sign up for.
All right. Madison Morris, Hope Gaborio, and Mindy Wolliver are members of the Vermont High School Rodeo Association. Madison, good luck in Lincoln, Nebraska. And thank you all for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Willow Zartarian, and directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We've got Bill Sayers, Common Sense Radio, coming up. Next at 11 o'clock, the governor's COVID-19 response news conference today will happen at noon, and we'll have that here on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.